silk was like nothing I'd ever worked with before, slippery and so fluid it was almost as if it were alive, slithering from my table onto the floor, sliding off the deck of my sewing machine if I was careless when I pulled the needle out, if I didn't have my hands right there to coax it to stay. I made the nightgown first. It was basically two bias-cut panels, A-shaped but just barely joined along the sides. I finished the hem late one night and then hung the gown on a hanger and put it in my closet, where it would be the first thing I saw when I woke the next morning. During those days of sewing, I felt distracted a lot. At work, I'd suddenly come to myself, a book in hand, a wall of shelves before me, and I'd actually have to shake my head to get myself clear of whatever stage of the sewing I'd been at when I'd stopped the night before. Victor shot me his usual looks of concern, and I gave him sad smiles, let him think it was all just too hard, having Mike in the hospital, that was my problem. Of course, that was my problem. I knew that every minute, sewing or not sewing, with Mike or not, and he got lower and lower, sometimes barely registered my presence. One evening I arrived for my visit and found him not lying on his bed but sitting in his wheelchair, a first for after dinner, a heavy strap holding his torso in place. "Wow, you're up," I said. "I can't believe it." He gave me a look. "What?" "Isn't it ironic? I'm a low quad and yet I'm up." A week ago he'd reported that he'd heard one of the physical therapy assistants using the phrase low quad in reference to another patient with a relatively low cervical spine injury. I looked around the room. All the mayors were there. Mr. and Mrs. in chairs opposite the foot of Mike's bed. Julie and John Jr. on the floor to the side. "Hard day?" I said. "Just the usual." "You seem tired." "I am." Mr. and Mrs. Mayer exchanged a glance, and I moved closer to Mike. "Are there too many people here?" I whispered. "Do you want me to go?" "If you want." "What do you want?" Mike's face went livid and he shouted, "Stop asking me what I want!" He stared at me with his eyes burning, his words bouncing off the hard surfaces of the room and keeping us both absolutely still. Finally, the color in his face began to drain away, and he said quite calmly, "Why do people keep asking me what I want? I want to walk out of here. Christ, I want to walk." Simon Rhodes called me one evening near the end of August, and we talked for almost 3 hours, the longest I'd spent doing anything but sewing in months. "So, what's new in the Carrie Bell saga?" he said. "Wait till you hear the latest in the Simon Rhodes saga." He told me about life in New York, about his problems with his boyfriend, about the big dilapidated brownstone he shared with a bunch of Yale friends, about the Park Avenue law firm where he worked as a proofreader. It had the unlikely name of Biggs, Leper, Rush, Creighton, and Fenelon, but he said all the proofreaders referred to it as the Big Leper Rush. What he really wanted was to be an illustrator. I told him about Mike's sadness, about how difficult it was to watch, about the rare moments when some piece of his former self came through, when he joked with Stu or Bill, ribbed Rooster about Joan. I'd catch his eye and there'd pass between us a recognition of the fact that he didn't have any of that available for me right now. "It sounds hard," Simon said, and I was grateful. I could tell him anything and it would be okay, the words zooming away from Madison, safely gone just moments after I'd uttered them. Before we hung up, I said I wanted to pay for half the call, but he wouldn't hear of it. "Are you kidding?" he said. "This is the most fun I've had since I played Twister at Nicole Patterson's birthday party in fourth grade."